You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. We are on Twitter at KUOW. You might have opinions to share about our next topic. You know, over the weekend, the University of Washington hosted a rally in Red Square by a right-wing group called Patriot Prayer. Its leader is Joey Gibson.
They say that I provoke. And you know what? It's kind of true because I go, if you tell me I can't go somewhere, I'm going to go there. I'm going to go there every time. You tell me I can't come out here and speak in an open public park, I'm going to come here no matter what. No matter what.
The Patriot Prayer ralliers were vastly outnumbered by people protesting them.
Say it loud, say it clear.
Racists are not welcome here.
Say it loud, say it clear.
Racists are not welcome here.
In fact, one protester at Red Square named Lucinda Stroud captured the dilemma that today's colleges are facing.
On the one hand, I do believe in free speech. And on the other hand, no one is arresting them for meeting or for speaking. But UW does not have to host them here.
Yes, there's the dilemma. How do we protect free speech on campus? Maybe host and sponsor free speech, maybe not, and at the same time protect the rights of all the students and the faculty and the staff. My guest is Seattle University Communications Professor Caitlin Carlson. She studies hate speech, and she sent a few of her students to Saturday's rally to cover it. Welcome, Professor.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You've seen video of the rally. You've talked with your students about it. First of all, since I said you study hate speech, did the group Patriot Prayer utter hate speech?
So my understanding, and again, I wasn't there, so I can't speak firsthand, but my understanding was that there wasn't necessarily hate speech in the official speeches or chants used by either group. I think, at least from what my student Hannah Duffy told me, was that it was when the altercations occurred. So I believe the Patriot Prayer group was kind of cordoned off in a particular area when they left that area and had, you know, skirmishes, I'll call them, with the counter-protesters. That's when I heard some racial epithets and other kinds of terms were actually used.
Okay. And are either you or your students suggesting that when this rally is being, the permit is being applied for, that the university would preemptively would prevent a Patriot Prayer group from speaking because of skirmishes that might happen?
Right. Well, this is where things get really messy, right? We definitely don't want to find ourselves in kind of an Orwellian future where ideas can be punished before they've even been spoken or been shared. And so I don't think that, at least what we talked about and in class, it was really interesting to watch this unfold with the, you know, the UW administration leveled this $17,000 security fee on the College Republicans ahead of time. And what a lot of us felt like, and myself included, was, well, that's going to have a chilling effect, right? That the purpose of that is really based on the content of the speech. And where things get kind of messy is, you know, I think it's easy for a lot of us, particularly in Seattle, to say, oh, Patriot Prayer Group, that's got no place on campus. Absolutely not. Right. But if we let administrators start regulating speech based on its content, what happens when they decide that Black Lives Matter doesn't get to come on campus, right? And so this question of when do we let the state, right? And I think one of the misnomers with UW or public colleges in general, I mean, according to the government, they're a traditional public forum. They're the same as being in Gasworks Park, right? Or being in Westlake Park. It's a place that time out of mind, people have come to share ideas. And so the fact that it, you know, harms student dignity or infringes on what professors are trying to teach there, I mean, those are the kind of rights that they need to balance with the free expression rights of the students.
Yes. Well, let's talk about some of the rights of students. On Friday, organizers of different campus events started canceling. The Young, Gifted, and Black Conference brings African-American high school students to campus to connect with students and faculty. The Everybody, Everybody fashion show canceled. International Students Culture Festival canceled, concerned over the safety, they said. Now, what should the university do with that information that groups will cancel if we host this rally?
Right. I think, you know, part of it is tricky, right? Because I think what the university is responding to or acting in accordance with is the law, right? So there is precedent that basically says, you know, it's not up to university administrator to decide how student fees are spent, even if students disagree with the content of the speakers being invited in, right? It's not the university's place to stop that. So they really do, in some ways, have their hands tied. They're not able to silence any of those speakers. What I think gets interesting is, you know, fundamentally, the reason that we're saying allow groups like Patriot Prayer onto campus is we want students to wrestle with controversial ideas, right? There's a really famous case called Papish v. University of Missouri, and the Supreme Court said there that, you know, the mere dissemination of ideas, no matter how offensive to good taste, on a state university campus may not be shut off in the name of conventions of decency, right? So they're really bound not to do this kind of content-based restriction. What's tricky for me is when we start hearing about other groups having their events canceled, or, you know, I know the UW administration sent an email to students saying steer clear of this area, right? That, right, to me, the logic is starting to get a little faulty, right? If the Supreme Court is saying, oh, you know, we want students to wrestle with ideas and that's why the law is the way it is. Well, you're now telling students don't go there. So to me, I think this might be one of those places where, you know, is it time for the First Amendment to change? Do we want to continue to protect hate speech in public spaces, which is what the law says now?
Well, what do you think? I opened up with this dilemma, this campus dilemma: protect free speech, protect the rights of the campus community. What's your solution? Solve this for us, Professor.
Right? I might work myself out of a job if I have a solution. So, you know, I'm not somebody that is of the mind that we need to change the First Amendment. I get really nervous about who gets to decide when and where expression gets to take place, right? So like my earlier example, I don't necessarily just personally trust the Trump administration at this point to make good decisions about what they label hate speech and can silence ahead of time, right? We have a really strong history in this country of being against prior restraints. We don't allow people to stop expression before it happens. And so I'm not necessarily of the mindset that we should tell people what to say ahead of time, but we can, I think, punish speech, especially low-value speech. So I could see a situation where we adopt an approach like Germany or some of these other places that use a fine or potential jail time to punish people if and when they use speech that crosses a line into infringing on others' dignity, right, using some of these racial, ethnic, misogynistic slurs.
How does Germany and how would you define dignity when it comes to cracking down on speech?
It gets really tricky, right?
Low-value speech.
Well, here, I think one of the examples that I tend to draw people's attention to is like commercial speech, right? So we don't think of all expression as equal, right? We tend to put political expression up on this pedestal and say things like commercial speech are less valuable. If I want to, like I said earlier, you know, if I want to have an advertisement that says, you know, drink this energy drink, you'll lose 20 pounds this week, right? That's illegal. They can stop that right away. Do we want to look at some of the harm caused by hate speech and say that's the reason for punishing it potentially after the fact?
Well, the obvious difference being we're saying one is lying to consumers and we've decided to build rules around that. How would you establish whether somebody's political opinion is a lie?
Well, and again, I think we have to be careful with saying, you know, all of these certain political opinions are hate speech. I think hate speech has a really clear designation as, you know, language or expression that demeans or dehumanizes another based on immutable characteristics, things they can't control. So race, gender, religion, et cetera, right? You know,
so you say something demeaning to someone based on race, gender, et cetera, and you would be arrested for
saying that? Not necessarily. See, again, that's where I would probably differ from Germany. I would say no criminal penalties necessarily, right? We have an option, right? We could do a criminal penalty, which would be a fine and jail time. We also have this idea, which Jeremy Waldron is one of the scholars who talks a lot about this, of a libel type of penalty. So it would be more like a civil suit, right? So if you say, you know, racial epithets or say these things to me that demean my reputation or diminish my reputation, perhaps we create an opportunity for me to then sue you to say these things harm my dignity or these things cause me emotional distress. I can sue you under one of these existing torts.
So, you'd have to prove a harm. Would the harm include my feelings are hurt or what kind of harm would
you
have to
prove? It's funny. We actually already have a tort that's about my feelings are hurt, which is intentional infliction of emotional distress, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the courts have not been favorable to applying that to hate speech. And that's where I say, oh, potentially there does need to be regulation, right? Because I think for a lot of folks, you know, the lack of regulation is the government saying this type of language is okay, which is what we've done, right? You guys probably remember the Snyder v. Phelps case where you've got people protesting outside of soldiers' funerals with signs that say all kinds of crazy things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Justice John Roberts said, even then, you know, as a nation, we've chosen a different course to protect even the most hurtful speech, to provide space for a robust public debate. Now let's bring it back to UW. Was what we saw there a robust public debate, right? Is what we're actually saying we're protecting, what's happening? And that's where I think it might be time, like I said, to explore whether that's civil penalties, criminal penalties, but you know, we do this differently than most other Western democracies, the European Union, Canada, South Africa, right? There are tons of places where, at least on the books, there are penalties for this kind of dehumanizing speech. And I would remind us, you know, there are scholars who study like the time before the Holocaust happened, right? And you can go back and look, and a lot of this kind of hate speech does tend to be the proverbial bark before the bite of things like racial genocide. So one of the things I'm sitting here wondering is, you know, are we going to have to go through our own kind of racial violence upheaval to get to a place where we're willing to say, you know, no, we're not looking to stop ideas, but we're at least putting together a framework that punishes people when they dehumanize or demean the dignity of others.
And finally, Professor, to bring it back to a rally like the one we just had at Red Square over the weekend, I don't hear you saying that the UW should prevent the next, let's say it's the Patriot Prayer Group or a similar group. I'm not hearing you say that the UW should not host that. How would you summarize your take on what the UW could do, if anything, with this dilemma that it faces, this free speech, protecting people's rights dilemma?
Right. They really are. They're in a tight spot. And so one of the things I always advocate for is counter speech, right? So what is it that the university is doing to kind of mitigate or combat that event, right? So we've seen at other campuses where schools have hosted like a major concert or some sort of event that just basically drowns out the kind of skirmish, you know, the little like, oh, this small group from Vancouver, Washington, who cares because Macklemore's here or whatever that would be, right? So exploring opportunities for counter speech. The other thing I think is, as much as it sucks, really, it does present a learning opportunity, right? So I would encourage professors, students to use this to think about, here's the regulatory structure we have now. Do we agree with it, right? Or is this something we're looking to potentially change? It's really interesting, you know, in studying this, I do see kind of a generational shift between folks. I'm just about 40, and so folks who are older than me are very much, you know, protect free expression at all cost. I think some of the younger folks, millennials in particular, are willing to look at, well, how does this impact, you know, my neighbor or people who don't necessarily have the same rights or privileges as I do? And is my right to free expression, again, more valuable or more important than their right to dignity? Or, you know, as we get into what happened this weekend and we're talking about canceling other events, again, now we're pitting different people's rights to assemble over your right to assemble and express yourself. And so I think they do need to carefully consider kind of how this impacts other groups and make sure every single group has that same access to whether it's funding or space on campus. Yeah.
This is Seattle University Communications Professor Caitlin Carlson. She studies hate speech. She sent some of her students to Saturday's rally to cover it. And we've been talking about how colleges can handle this dilemma that just seems to be inflamed these days over hosting free speech and protecting the rights of the people that want to learn and live and work on campuses. Professor, thanks a lot for this.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate being here.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. I'd like to hear what you think. We're on Twitter at KUOW. We'll be right back. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. I'm Bill Radke. Amazon is laying off several hundred employees at its Seattle headquarters. The Seattle Times first reported that today. Here to tell you more is Todd Bishop from Seattle's tech news site, GeekWire. Hiya, Todd.
How's it going, Bill?
It's good, thanks. I'm not an Amazon corporate employee facing a layoff, so it's good. But we don't know yet what several hundred people means. How many hundred is that?
We're hearing overall between Seattle and other places around the country, roughly 500 people overall. And this is essentially—
That's not massive.
It's not massive, especially when you're talking about a company with more than 560,000 employees around the world, yeah. About 40,000 in Seattle itself. That said, I think it's an indication that Amazon might have grown just a little bit faster than the company's top executives might have wanted. And it's also, underscoring the notion of frugality, which is one of Amazon's core leadership principles, and this whole notion that even as they take over the world, they need to be careful about it in terms of expenses.
Yeah. It's a small number of workers, but it's just not what we're used to from Amazon. And what kind of people are being let go?
This is within Amazon's core consumer retail business. So it's a variety of employees at headquarters. And the whole notion is that this is somewhat unusual for them. This is the type of thing that really indicates a bit of a right sizing, I guess, would be the corporate phrase.
Right. Okay. So right sizing, frugality. This isn't about Amazon looking for a different headquarters and like moving people out of Seattle. It's not that.
It does not seem to be that. The company is still hiring aggressively. It has more than 4,000 open positions overall in the Seattle area. And this is the type of thing that companies sometimes do. They have still been leasing new office spaces around Seattle, even as they search for a second corporate headquarters somewhere else in North America.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about that. But by the way, stock investors are happy with Amazon right now. Stock up 4% right now on this news of 500 or so layoffs. Speaking of the look for a different headquarters, you just got out of, what'd you say, the PGH?
Yeah, just back from Pittsburgh.
Yeah. One of 20 finalists for Amazon's new headquarters. Why'd you go to Pittsburgh?
We decided that we would conduct our own search for GeekWire HQ2.
Uh-huh.
So we put out...
You're leaving?
No, we're not. Okay. This is a temporary headquarters for the month of February. GeekWire reporters and editors are cycling through Pittsburgh, which was selected from among 10 proposals that we received from around the country in response to our offer to bring up to 3 paying jobs, high paying jobs, medium paying jobs.
Yes.
at any given point.
Can we offer you some tax breaks and financial incentives?
We received none. Okay. So we have been looking at Pittsburgh. We're covering Pittsburgh for this month, much as we cover Seattle for the rest of the time. But as part of that, we have been looking at Pittsburgh's bid for Amazon HQ2 as a window into the ways that these communities around the country are going after Amazon's second headquarters. And I'll tell you, it has been eye-opening because the perspective in Seattle on Amazon and its growth is radically different from the way that leaders in Pittsburgh and other parts of the country look at this prize.
How so?
We sat down with Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, and one of the things that he was adamant about was that if Amazon were to come to Pittsburgh, the city and the company would work together, hand in hand, to realize a glorious future for this former steel city and its 300,000 residents. Now,
says him, is the company.
I don't have to tell folks in Seattle that is not the way it has worked here. Uh-huh. And there were times in our conversation with the mayor where we had to sort of dial it back because we sort of got into consulting realm where we were explaining to him, Mayor Peduto, this is not the way it's worked here. Now, it is an illustration of the fact that Amazon, in its request for proposals to these cities, really portrayed itself as a warm and fuzzy company, ready to really work with any city, wherever it puts HQ2, to make sure that whatever growth it brings with this $5 billion campus and 50,000 employees is beneficial to all. Now, whether or not that happens, I just think these cities need to start looking at what's actually happened in Seattle, at least as a cautionary tale, to know that it's what they need to avoid in terms of traffic and, you know, the high cost of housing, displacement, everything that we've seen here with the growth of not only Amazon, but the rest of the tech industry.
So you're saying that Pittsburgh, for example, would love to be a partner with Amazon in like a planned city. We're going to figure out all these challenges and get ahead of it. And you're saying that has Amazon shown no willingness to do that?
Certainly in the HQ2 process they have. But if you look at their habits with HQ1, where only now are they sitting down for meetings with Seattle city leaders to talk about the future, that has not been their pattern in the past. Now, I think it's important to give Amazon the benefit of the doubt as it relates to Amazon HQ2. They may well be changing their ways. And one interesting aspect, I think Pittsburgh is a long shot for HQ2. That said, Amazon executives, including Jeff Wilkie, the CEO of the consumer business at Amazon, he is from Pittsburgh. And so there is some of that approach inside the company. But just to give you another example, the mayor of Pittsburgh told us he thinks he understands Amazon's corporate ethos because he's a regular reader of the Washington Post editorial page. And he sees in those commentaries what must be Jeff Bezos's very worker-friendly and and democratic approach to the world. And we stopped him and we said, wait a second. Jeff Bezos is believed to be a libertarian. He's been described that way, a libertarian with a lowercase l. He certainly, if he didn't move or put Amazon in Seattle and Washington State because of the lack of the income tax, he certainly, you know, has championed that whole approach. And so it's a really interesting disconnect between a lot of these cities and their perception of Amazon and the realities we've seen here in Seattle.
And did you learn any, it sounds like you have some lessons for Pittsburgh. Did you learn any lessons for us?
Yes, absolutely. There was a remarkable cultural difference between Seattle and Pittsburgh. And, you know, I've lived here for, coming up on 20 years in Seattle. I'm not a native, but I've lived here for a long time. I was astonished at the openness, the friendliness, the just general willingness of the people in Pittsburgh to engage with outsiders in a genuine way. There is
call it the Pittsburgh thaw, if you will.
Exactly, exactly. There is no Pittsburgh freeze. And frankly, even just coming back here to Seattle for 2 days, it's almost been a reverse culture shock for me and an eye-opener for how closed off our culture can be. And frankly, it raises questions for me about how Amazon and its employees, those at least that come from Seattle, will fit in some of these Midwest cities, especially as you're talking about someplace. I think of Pittsburgh more as a Midwest ethos,
yeah,
even though it's sort of on the border.
It's Western Pennsylvania. It's almost,
yes,
Ohio.
It really is. It really is. So as you're looking at some of these different places where Amazon could go, I think we've been focused so much on the numbers and the jobs and the RFP. I think there's a lot of intangibles that these cities need to think about in terms of whether Amazon is the right fit. And we actually did see this past week forums at the University of Pittsburgh in downtown Pittsburgh that we covered as part of our HQ2 project, where people are very concerned about the impact of Amazon if it were to choose Pittsburgh for HQ2.
GeekWire's Todd Bishop is just back from Pittsburgh, and you can tell it's weird. He's trying to make eye contact with me. It's very, very awkward. Todd, thanks for...
Bill, maybe you can come over for dinner this week.
Yeah. I'll probably get back to you.
Yeah. Let me know. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
can I get your number?
Yeah, you know what? Well, let me get to you. I'll call you if
maybe
I...
a little later?
Probably.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
See you, Todd. It's KOW's The Record. Back in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. You know, we talk so much these days about how you should get out of your bubble. You should get out of your bubble. But boy, did my next guest do that. Arlie Hochschild is a professor emerita of sociology at UC Berkeley, and she spent 5 years in basically the Louisiana Bayou trying to understand Tea Party supporters and that culture there. And her book about that experience was a National Book Award finalist called Strangers in Their Own Land, just about to come out in paperback. Professor Hochschild, welcome.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Bill.
Do you mind telling me what your politics were going in to this trip?
The same ones that they are coming out.
Okay.
I'm a progressive.
Uh-huh.
So Berkeley born, sort of forged by the 1960s, you could say. I was a civil rights worker in 1964, Freedom Summer. That was the summer that three civil rights workers were murdered. So that was the kind of South as I understood it earlier.
Yeah.
But then there was the free speech movement and the feminist movement. And I came to work in the department where there were no women. So that's the self that I am. That was the bubble, because I'm not alone in that whole experience. You know, obviously younger people, but...
Why did you want to get out of that bubble?
Well, I realized in 2011 that actually everything that I wanted to happen did require some faith in government, that, you know, it can be part, not the whole, but part of a solution to work-family balance issues. Let's get paid parental leave. Let's get flexible workplaces, race, you know, let's get job opportunities and so on. And I realized that what was really growing, I knew, which was the Tea Party at the time, that I knew nothing about it, didn't know anybody in the Tea Party. So I thought, you know what? I'm in a bubble, in a geographic bubble, coastal bubble, blue bubble. Also, I'm, in a media bubble. I'm reading the New York Times and the Washington Post and Mother Jones Magazine.
Yeah.
And I'm in an electronic bubble because I look at my laptop and it gives me myself back again. So I thought, let me get into a bubble as far right as Berkeley, California is left. Take off my moral and political alarm system. Permit myself real strong curiosity about this world and see if I can cross an empathy bridge.
I was just going to ask you whether curiosity and empathy have to go hand in hand. You mentioned gadgets. Is there a telephone that we can turn off? I heard a phone ringing and it ain't mine. Well, we'll find it. We're going to find that phone disengage it. We're talking with Arlie Hochschild, who is at Seattle University, the Piggott Auditorium, tonight, 7:30. And you're talking with UW political science professor Christopher Parker.
I'm looking forward to it.
What message do you want to give to Seattle tonight?
Well, I guess I want to share my journey to the other side and share more recent post-book visits back.
Yeah, this was pre-Trump when you wrote this book.
Yeah. But I saw the steam behind the right. And
did you predict the Trump election?
I can't say that I did. What? Because I was reading the New York Times and back in my bubble.
Mother Jones.
You bet. But it didn't surprise me. I saw the great enthusiasm. I went to a Trump primary rally with one of the Tea Party women that I'd been following. And I just saw thousands of people with signs and saw a man say, oh, to be in the presence of Donald Trump. You know, I thought, wow, now I see I've spent 4 years of studying the dry tinder. And now I see the match.
Have you been continuing to see how the Trump presidency is playing outside of your bubble, outside the Berkeley and Seattle bubble? And what do you have to tell us about that?
The bloom is a little bit off the rose. If you talk to people, that is, don't look just at their Facebook pages, because they're fierce and strong and in warrior mode. But if you talk to them personally, you go out fishing, which is a wonderful way to talk to people. You know, you're in this boat and got some time. And one guy who's ardent Trump person, I was out with him fishing. And I said, do you have any reservations about Donald Trump? And his answer was, where do I begin? So they didn't see anything else for them on the Democratic side. They didn't. That's the thing to bear in mind, you know. So he's still their guy, but they don't love him, but he's still very much their guy. They'll defend him. And actually, if Mueller were to find evidence and grounds for impeachment, and an impeachment process was to begin, I would predict a great deal of turmoil on that side, because they just don't see an alternative to him. Everything else looks very like the Republican Party. They feel the Democratic Party, that's the conventional Republican Party, they feel unacknowledged by, they feel bypassed by, they feel sneered at. So I went into this with the red state paradox. How could it be that the poorest states, the states with the most disrupted family, worst education, worst health care, who take more money from the federal government in aid than they give to it in tax dollars, hate and suspect the federal government. That was the that's kind of the red state paradox I began the journey with, but I came out of it with a blue state paradox. How could it be that the Democratic Party, the party of the working man and the working woman, does not speak to them? That's the paradox that I deliver back in this book to the reader.
What's your answer? Explain that blue state paradox.
Well, I think, first of all, that leaders in the Democratic Party and voters are really out of touch with the kind of people I came to know, who feel very pushed back. And so, first of all, I think we need bridges. That doesn't mean we blur into each other. It means that you embrace a coalitional politics, a results-oriented politics. You don't do an enclave politics where you just talk to each other within a bubble. You see what crossover grounds there are, and there are a lot, like reducing, for example, the size of prison populations. Now, each side has different reasons, but they both, the people I talked to were all for that, getting money out of politics, all for that. Do they want a nuclear war with North Korea? They do not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, looking for diplomatic answers there, they'd be with you on that. So there are some surprising crossovers. If you are respectful, and we need bridges, I guess that's one takeaway here. I don't think it's the only thing we have to do. I don't think it's actually the first thing we have to do, but which is defend democracy. But I think we need to do it, and we can do it.
UC Berkeley sociology professor emerita, and the book is Strangers in Their Own Land. I'm curious about you personally. You spent 5 years with basically another tribe, another political tribe. How accepted were you at the end of those 5 years? Do you feel like you've got membership in two different tribes now? Not your political opinions,
no.
But can you move as a human being among these tribes?
That was the biggest surprise. And I told them exactly who I was and what I was doing.
Okay, you didn't hide anything.
No. So I was, like Mary Poppins, just kind of came out of the sky, you know. And hi, I'm Arlie Hochschild, the unpronounceable last name. I teach sociology at UC Berkeley. And
I'm an elitist.
Right. I'm in a bubble, but I think we're all in a bubble. Mm. And I'm worried about this divide. And then you'd get a nodding head. Yeah, we're worried about the divide, too. And then the next thing they would say is, but we feel that people on the coast like you don't understand us. You think we're the flyover state. You think we're backward. You think we're hicks. You think we're ill-educated. You think we're racist and homophobic and sexist and fat and rednecks. And we resent all of these attributions being put on. So you write a book. I would always say I'm writing a book. You set them straight. I said, well, what I'm asking of you, I don't, you know, promise to agree with you. I am from a product of my experience, just as you are. But I promise to say what I have honestly seen and how I understand your experience and understand what I came to think of as their deep story. And this is an important part of this book, that underneath all the attitudes I feel both right and left have a deep story. And so what's that? That's a story that feels true about a salient situation. You take facts out of the deep story. You take moral precepts is out of the deep story. It's just what feels true to you. And so hanging out and asking people where they went to school, visiting their graveyards and churches, going to church with them, and really getting to know them in this way, I kind of distilled what I felt was a right-wing deep story. And then I tried it out on them. Does this ring a bell? Is this how it feels to you? And they said, oh, you read my mind. Well, that's, yeah. Or they would say, I'm going to change it. No, you forgot something. And
this is the story of them essentially being standing in line while others are cutting ahead.
That's exactly right. It's as in a pilgrimage. At the top of the hill is the American dream, and their shoes are pointed toward it. But the line hasn't moved in 2 decades. Nobody I've talked to had gotten a raise in 2 decades. And then they, in this right-wing deep story, feel that people are cutting in line through federally mandated affirmative action programs. So the federal government was seen as the author of this. Blacks were finally given access to jobs that had always been reserved for whites. Even worse, women, half the population and more, are finally given access to jobs that used to be reserved for men. And then they saw undocumented immigrants and even birds, like the brown pelican, oil-soaked. I was in the oil in petrochemical center around Lake Charles. High, high pollution. So this oil-soaked pelican would rock and walk up and also seemed to be cutting in line ahead of them. Many people said, oh, those environmentalists, those West Coast environmentalists are putting animals ahead of people. So all these were lies.
Professor, some of my listeners are hearing this and thinking, yeah, they have a story. We all have stories. That's an ignorant, backward, you know, racist, know-nothing story. Why do I have to respect that?
You don't have to respect it, but you do have to understand where that came from in their experience. And then you check out Appendix 3 of this book, which are the facts as I've documented them using the Bureau of Census and various other source of reliable data. So there's a disconnect between the deep story and the facts. But I suggest that we've got a deep story too. And actually, I see two avenues forward.
Can I ask you first, what's the blue state deep story that's also devoid of facts or, what else did you say, moral reasoning? Or,
yeah.
You know, what's that story? And is it just as distorted in your mind?
Well, okay, it's my story.
Yeah, your
true
story.
So I'm less objective about this. And this is a guess. I'm less sure of this one. I haven't really hung out and done the same thing on my side as I have on theirs. But
maybe we need someone from their group to do that.
Yes, yes. We do, I think.
Go on.
But I would say it's that, again, told in a dreamlike metaphoric way, that we're all ranged around a public square. And the people who are facing this public square are looking at a state-of-the-art children's science museum, brilliantly put together, really creative. And the kids love it. Kids of all colors and incomes can come and learn about science. And next to that are some public parks. Again, really innovative and exercises that are available to people of all sorts. And there's a nature conservancy. It's all of this public goods, public wealth, if you will. And people think, well, it doesn't have to be all government. It can be nonprofits. It can be community service, individuals stepping forward. But we feel a part of that. And we don't begrudge our taxes to go to that because it's incorporative and it's invitational and it's democracy at its best. Another moment of left deep story is that this backhoe comes and it from the outside of the public square and it digs down into the very foundation concrete of that state-of-the-art children's science museum. It lifts it out and takes that foundation to begin to build a McMansion for the 1%, private realm. Well, that feels like a theft. And there's anguish and anger at that.
Okay, so then in the minute we have left, Professor, you've observed the Bayou Tea Party story. You're reflecting on the Blue Bubble story. You're here in Seattle tonight to speak. What's a lesson that we can take away from your good work?
Well, I think the lesson is we should all get active. I think this is a very important and to some degree frightening moment in history. And I would say there are several pillars of activism. One is go out and do everything you can to defend the principle of checks and balances, that, you know, the freedom of the press, the independence of the judiciary, because the president is kicking at this foundation. That's number one. Don't have to talk to anybody not like you to do that. Mm-hmm. Number two, revamp the Democratic Party platform. Don't have to, again, talk to anyone different from you to do that. Number three, get the vote out again. But number four, realize that you don't have to do it, but you should appreciate some people are trying to make this effort for in search of common grounds. And there is an unrecognized mass movement now, grassroots movement, that you'll find if you look at the Bridge Alliance, which is an umbrella group that covers some 80 organizations with funny names like High from the Other Side or Living Room Conversations, where you get people on opposite sides. They know they don't agree on most things, but they search for common ground on a particular thing. I think it'd be good for all of us to do that.
The author of Strangers in Their Own Land is sociology professor emerita from UC Berkeley, Arlie Hochschild, who spent 5 years in the Louisiana Bayou, and now she's going to be in Seattle, Washington, at Seattle University. Tonight, 7:30, the Piggott Auditorium with University of Washington political science professor Christopher Parker. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
Wonderful talking with you, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. Back in a moment. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. What is the most popular Winter Olympic sport? Well, figure skating, says Google, the most searched for Winter Olympic event over the last year in all but four states. Montana and Alaska were more curious about snowboarding. Nebraska wanted to learn about curling, and Minnesota was looking for information about hockey. Okay, that's the searching. How about the best Winter Olympic event? Well, for that, we invited a few members of Seattle's sketch comedy group, The Habit, Mark Ciano, Lucas Thayer, and David Swidler, to come in and settle it for us with a Winter Olympics fantasy draft.
I love the Olympic theme. It is really good, especially with the timpanis at the beginning. The dong.
It's awe-inspiring.
Dong.
Anyways, we are going to draft our favorite Winter Olympic sports, right?
Yes.
Okay, I can do that. I know what I'm going to pick. I think I'm the third pick, which makes me a little nervous because you guys go first, and
backstage, we flip the gold medal.
Who won the flip?
I did.
Dave goes first.
Yeah. So Dave's going first.
And with my first pick, I'm going to take freestyle skiing. Oh. And I'm taking freestyle skiing because that means I get ski cross and snowboard cross. Now, unlike other ski races where they go down one by one, this is an actual race where you have four competitors at the same time going down the course. And this course, oh, brother, if you like courses, this course has it all. It's got it's got big air jumps. It's got high bank turns. It's got a chance of a photo finish.
Wow, Dave, that was a very thorough pick. I feel like someone prepared.
So I'll go second then. I was just going to pick hockey because I love hockey.
That's a good
one. Hockey's the best.
You know why I like that pick, Mark? Because it's in line with who you are. You're a big hockey fan. You're a hockey guy.
I played hockey as a kid. I'm super stoked that Seattle's going to have a team soon.
But here's my problem with hockey this year.
Not, oh, gosh.
No. Whoa.
Not the women's tournament. The women's tournament, they've got the best players in the world. That's good.
Yes.
The men's tournament, the NHL players aren't going to be there. So basically, everyone has to go back to their country and say, can anyone else here play hockey?
You just drive the bus.
Exactly. Just drive the bus, drop them off. Can you play hockey? Guys. Well, okay, get on. We're going to Korea.
Hockey's a good pick. Thanks. All right. I am up next, with the third pick. And honestly, you guys, I cannot believe that nobody picked this first. I was really sweating that somebody would choose this. I'm going to choose curling. Curling. Because it combines two of my favorite things, sweeping and throwing rocks.
You love sweeping.
You love
to sweep. Love sweeping.
Yeah.
If we had a chores draft, I think I would take sweeping first. Because number one, immediate impact, right?
Right.
Like results are immediate.
Yeah.
Like you sweep a room.
You either...
I'm not talking about the actual sport at this
okay.
point.
Okay.
No, I've got kind of a tangent on sweeping.
But in five minutes.
I'm saying in general, sweeping, best chore.
Here's my question to you, though. Do you think vacuuming has destroyed sweeping?
I think of vacuuming as advanced sweeping.
But if I went back to, like, I don't know, 1758, and there's a guy sweeping his room, and I brought a vacuum, and he'd be like, no, I want that vacuum. And like, you know, I'm good with the broom.
I think it's round two.
Round two.
David Splinter.
Dave, what are you doing?
I'm dropping a beat.
The Olympic beat is a timpani, right? It sounds like a giant. It's dong, 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 dong.
I'm going to go with the biathlon.
Nice.
Oh.
You got skiing and shooting.
I'd like to say for my second pick, I'm going to take short track speed skating.
Yeah,
There you go.
What if instead of on skates, you were still on the ice, but you had to run?
You know what? I think ice running would be a great sport.
I think we need to send a sternly worded letter to them.
Yeah. I think Usain Bolt's pretty great, but can he do it on ice?
Can he do it on ice?
Can he do it on ice?
I don't think that he can. I think that Usain Bolt and myself would have a 50-50 shot at winning if the event was ice running. Like, as all his advantages are gone.
I think you're giving yourself a little bit credit. I don't think ice is the reason you're not as fast as Usain Bolt. I don't think that's the reason.
That's pretty much the only
I'm
reason.
I'm sure it's like, Usain Bolt is like, if I ever see Luke Thayer, open out on ice because I got no chance.
Okay, with my pick, this is the third pick in the second round.
Yes.
I am going to choose bobsled.
Oh.
Bobsled. You know, I like bobsled, just not even withstanding the potential for death around every turn.
Right, which is great.
Okay. I like to imagine how, like, the bobsledding evolved from, like, one guy, and he's like, I bet you can't do it with two guys. And they're like, and then two guys, they did it really good. And like, well, what if we added a third guy, right? And then finally they got to the four guys, and at that point they were like, okay, that's enough.
Like, we're really the fifth guy, and they're like, no.
No.
Sorry,
what
guys.
What do you know?
Ruining the whole sport.
Yeah, you're taking this.
It's ridiculous. We're five
purists.
Guys in a bobsled. When the Olympics were in Vancouver, I went to the bobsledding. And you stand out in the cold, and you just have a view of one part of the track. And you just hear off in the distance people cheering gets loud, and all of a sudden, meow. Sometimes you see the bobsled go by, and then you see one guy
see,
just.
That's what I would...
Did we win? Did we win? We planned this differently. Like walking down the bobsled. It's going to be the saddest thing you can do in sports.
Do you think there's like a lifeguard at the top that's like, wait here? Wait, you can't go until the tube is cleared.
Yeah, how come there's no water slide in the Olympics, right? Like
even
how
in the summer Olympics.
Summer Olympics, I think you're thinking of. A water slide in the Winter Olympics would just be
cold.
It'd be bobsledding, actually.
That's why. You answered your own question.
I feel we drafted all six events. So I feel really good about
six,
that. There's
right.
only six events.
Yeah.
And
wait, no one took
it's not an event.
Figure skating?
You know what else didn't get picked?
What's that?
Luge.
Oh, luge.
What's the difference between luge and skeleton?
Ooh, skeleton is face first. Yeah, you use your face to steer.
I have something to say about ski jumping.
Okay.
Yeah,
that just looks dumb.
It does?
It looks dangerous.
Oh, well, dangerous and dumb are two different things.
Well, really?
Well,
Have you read a newspaper recently? I mean,
no one did any snowboarding.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a sport for the young kids.
Yeah, I don't have time for that.
That's a young man's game.
Yeah, right? That kid with the red hair flipping around.
I will say this about the kid with the red hair, Sean White.
Yeah, yeah.
Since you only see the Olympics every 4 years, mm-hmm. it is jarring to see him. Because it's like yeah. the first time you saw him, he was yeah. like this little kid. And now he's like an old man. And I've seen him maybe like 4 times in my life. It's like, is this what's happening to me? I hope not.
All right, well, you guys, I feel like this was a successful draft.
I
yeah?
do, too.
Yeah, that was a really good
job.
Draft.
I think we all got our picks in there.
Yeah.
Once again, we're The Habit. We do fantasy drafts. We have a podcast.
It's The Habit Fantasy Draft Podcast.
Yeah.
And we are season 2 premieres on March 4th or 5th.
We're not sure yet.
One of those days.
One of those dates.
Let's say March 5th. How about that?
That gives us an extra day.
If we get an extra day, we're going to use it.
Right. Yeah. Really get it on iTunes. Really good.
Really good.
Cemented on iTunes.
Yeah.
That's Mark Ciano, Lucas Thayer, and David Swidler of the Seattle sketch comedy group The Habit. They do a variety of fantasy drafts. They draft holidays. They draft hats. And that's it for today's show. Our producers are Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, Bree Ripley on the tweets. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.